This goes. Can you guys hear me? I'll probably be too loud pretty soon. I'm Connie. I'm an alcoholic. Bill, thank you for inviting me. You guys, thank you. This is an honor. My sponsor told me that, you know, when you're invited to speak, you should step up and speak. So when Bill called, I heard her voice, and I went, oh, okay, here I am. You can tell I'm a little bit nervous, but just bear with me. I started drinking, I'd say about 12 or 13, just a normal let's have a party type drink, and I enjoyed it. I mean, most all my drinking career, I enjoyed drinking. It got to the point where, you know, even in high school, I was good in school. I was very active in sports, good student. But yet, you know, I had this downfall that was slowly killing me as I was drinking. Managed to make it through high school. I remember I would be out in the courtyard. Don't ask me how this would happen, but I remember vividly. I was a little high and had a few drinks in me in my junior year. And my high school, there was a courtyard, and the buildings were all around. And I'm out there. I'm supposed to be in history course. And the principal was sitting out in the bench with me and never said anything, never got me in trouble. He just, because I was one of those good kids who seemed to get away with everything. So, you know, I kept thinking, I have everything under control. I'm doing good. So went on. And actually, I quit my high school year because, you know, high school just wasn't, you know, it wasn't teaching me enough. I was too smart for this high school. So I'm going to quit high school. I'm going to drop out. Took the GED and then took my college exam. Went directly into college. Well, you know, that worked for me. And actually, I sort of slowed down on my drinking because I was going to college and decided it's time to, you know, settle down a little bit. But then, you know, college was getting tougher. I had to work a job and go to school. And so I needed something to keep me going. So I dabbled a little bit and some other, you know, issues. And then I'd drink to come down. And then I'd take some pills to come up and drink to come down. And this went on. And I got a career in the hotel business, managing hotels. And I really thought, you know, I was hot, you know, hot shit. I'm a 19-year-old kid. I'm a manager of a hotel. I have people, you know, 30, 40 years old working under me. And I could go out to those business luncheons. You know, and you had to have a drink with your clients. We always called them toddies. I guess that made them, it sound better. I wasn't having drinks. I wasn't getting drunk. I was having social toddies. You know, so it's just like upper class thing that I thought I had going on here. So full of myself. But my drinking continued, and so did my career. But I was finding I was drinking more and more. Ended up in L.A. running a hotel. And it was a funny thing. I would have a bottle in my car, my coffee cup when I walked into work didn't have coffee in it. One day the corporate office came down and I had a few drinks and, you know, I thought I was fine, and oddly enough so did everyone else because corporate office didn't even know any different. That day I ended up disciplining two of my employees because I noticed that they had left the hotel and came back with fountain drinks. Because we're having like a grand opening for our hotel. And being an alcoholic, but I didn't admit it at that time, I knew those things didn't have just Coke in them. So I went over to one of the employees and I, you know, said, let me have a sip, I'm thirsty. Took a drink and of course it was rum and Coke. Needlessly to say, I proceeded then to call the employees into the office, give them all written warnings, you know, two more strikes and you're out. You know, and I'm doing all this while I'm technically drunk. So it's just amazing what I was doing. I was drinking and driving. And I knew I had a problem. At that point, I knew I had a problem. And I did go to an AA meeting down in the LA area. And I walked in there, and of course I'm prim and proper. I'm a hotel manager, and you know, my poop doesn't smell. And I saw what I thought were these lower class people. You know, they were the drunks. I thought, you know, you had to have a bag over the bottle, and you know, they weren't having toddies like I was. They were drinking out of the bottle. So that wasn't for me. Needlessly to say, I ended up losing that job. Actually, it was they gave me a choice of being fired or quitting. So I quit. I didn't need that. And I came back. I came to where I was born in Bakersfield. So I'm thinking now, you know, I've changed places. I'm going to be in good shape. Now I'm not around all that. The pressure wasn't there. I wasn't alone in a strange town. So I went back to Bakersfield, moved in with my parents. I'm now like 27 years old, and I'm living with mom and dad. But as time went by there, once again, I was waking up in the morning, and my coffee cup was full of, and I drank Seagram 7. It didn't need any 7-Up in it. It's just straight Seagram 7. And I just hung on to that cup because I was so ghastly afraid that my mom or dad would just accidentally pick up my cup and, you know, drink out of it. So I would carry around this coffee cup all day long. And, you know, I thought I had it under control. No one ever called me on it. No one ever said anything. Ended up getting married to a gentleman who could drink like I drank, but he was actually better at it. He could drink more than me. He's a Portuguese man that can really put down the whiskey. And so I think I made it my primary goal to try to keep up. But he didn't like me much drinking, you know, all that much. So then I decided, well, I'll put a bottle in the side of my nightstand. And so when he wasn't, you know, if he was sleeping and he'd sleep like a rock, I would take drinks, you know, out of the nightstand. And slowly and surely, I knew I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker because, you know, I came to a point, like many of us do, I could not drink. When I first came here, I used to pride myself. I would hear about people, I had withdrawals, and I would, you know, have the shakes, and I, you know, da da da. And I'm like going, not me. I never had those. Well, hell, of course I didn't have them. I had the money and the resources. I always had a bottle. I start feeling a little iffy. I just take another drink. For the last 4 years of my drinking, I really honestly can say that there would not have been an hour of the day that I was not legally drunk. People used to say to me, Connie, we didn't know you had a drinking problem. We didn't know you drank. You know, and after I got sober, I used to tell them, I said, you guys just never ever saw me sober. You had nothing to compare it to. You know, they just thought maybe I was a little off, or I was just, you know, a fun person to be around. But I was drunk. Golf drunk. Drove drunk. Went to many, many school functions. I have a 16-year-old daughter. Always active. But I was at going to school drunk. But they didn't have anything to compare it to. I wasn't one of those fall down, slur the speech, get in fights, dance on tables type drunks. I was just one of those, like, even keel, and if I started feeling, whether it be angry or sad, I'd take another drink. And I enjoyed drinking for a long, long time. I once went to the doctor I had, and I told him, I said, I think, you know, I drink too much. And his reply was, well, drink a lot of water in between drinks. Well, I no longer have that doctor, because I realized that was just asinine. You know, I guess I'd just be a drunk who needs to pee a lot. I don't know. So anyways, my drinking continued on and on to where I just could not drink. I went to an ice skating rink with my daughter and her class. No one knew, but I was drunk, and I just thought I could ice skate. I did when I was little. It took me about 2 minutes on the ice before I fell on my head and fractured my back and gave myself a concussion. I was drunk. Where my drinking finally left me was just having to have a drink constantly. It was taking control of me. I didn't realize it. Well, I knew it then, but I really didn't know what to do about it. And since no one complained, I didn't seem I was hurting anyone. I just kept on drinking. What led me to come into AA was, once again, I was on a field trip with my daughter up to Sacramento to see the state capitol. I knew I wouldn't be able to drink, and I knew I was going to be like a little icky, but, you know, I could handle it. Went on the field trip, spent the night, woke up next morning, haven't had a drink now for a little while, and we're walking around the museum, and we went to the theater, and we went, and now I'm starting to shake. And my legs are getting a little rubbery, going up and down steps, just like, this isn't good. Get to the state capitol, and everyone could see something was wrong, so the kids and everyone else had to take the stairs. But they let me take the elevator, because I would have never made the stairs. And I knew what was going on, but everyone else just thought, well, are you diabetic? Are you having some kind of a, you know, reaction? Are you, you know, like, no, I'm just a little sick. Well, the day went on, and then when it was time to, it's been like 2 days now, and then the time comes, we're all sitting out by the pool getting ready for the train to take us back, and I'm feeling like crap. And we're sitting out by the pool, and they said, okay, well, it's time to go. And that's about all I remember, was putting my arms down to stand up to walk to the train. That's it. That's all I remember. So I woke up in the hospital in Sacramento with IVs coming out of me. And I'd had, I guess, a grand mal seizure. Well, now we knew it wasn't just diabetes or some sickness. Well, it was a sickness. It was alcoholism. And I had alcohol withdrawals. So at this point, I could no longer say, well, I've never had a withdrawal. Because, you know, when I do something, I got to do it all the way. So I had a seizure. No idea that you cannot just quit drinking. Your body won't allow it. I learned that the hard way. It was the most devastating, humiliating experience of my life. I did this seizure in front of 60 fourth grade students, my daughter included. After that point, I was so blessed. I woke up from the hospital. My husband and my brother-in-law came and got myself, and a teacher had to stay behind with me, and drove up to Sacramento and brought us home. The whole time, you know, I was so relieved. It was finally over. Everyone knew, point blank, they couldn't hide from it, that I was an alcoholic, that I needed help. I was given a gift that day. I could have had that seizure at home. I could have had this, you know, seizure in a supermarket, and I don't think it would have stopped me, because I loved alcohol. I absolutely loved it. I felt pretty. I felt thin. I felt important. I felt superior. I was never wrong. You know, like saying I used to always say, you know, you can do it two ways. You can do it your way, or you can do it the right way, which is my way. Wrong way or right way. And I still find myself, though, sliding back into that. I know when I do it. I was in Monterey. Well, I don't know when I do it, but I know I'm still doing it. Because we were in Monterey this last weekend, and my daughter bought me a little plaque thing to put on the refrigerator. And on it, it says, I may have my faults, but being wrong isn't one of them. So I guess it's my daughter's way of saying, Mom, you know, you still got that little bit of an attitude going on you. I told my daughter, when this happened, you know, I got help. You know, I made a promise to her, and at the time I didn't realize that, you know, I pray to God that it's a promise I can always keep, but I promised her never to drink and to do that to her again. And so far, one day at a time, I've been able to keep that promise. I didn't come in to AA at first really looking for God. I was doing it for my daughter. And to me, I don't care how you get here or why you get here. You know, you got here. I don't care if the tree next door to you spoke to you and said, go to AA. If you're here, you're here, and that's a good thing. I spent my first, I went into, in fact, a friend of mine who's here, came over and spoke and did like a 12-step. Didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Really didn't want to hear. I just wanted to know how to get help. But the help was I ended up going into a outpatient where I met Bill and many other wonderful people. And that, once again, was a godsend. I got the info. I wasn't crazy. I was sick. There was something wrong with my body. I could no longer process the drug. My mind wasn't working, which I consider alcohol as a drug. I couldn't process it. I took a drink, and I was going to continue to drink because I was stupid. My brain just stopped working. I found, you know, once again, I used to go back even when I was in rehab, and I still have that I'm better than thou type attitude. You know, I'm here to get the information. I don't want to drink. Knock on some wood. You know, I was blessed, so blessed with the gift of, after that seizure, and it's been a little over 6 years now, I have never wanted a drink. Now, that doesn't say that I haven't been, you know, sitting on the beach and think, I'm glad wine might taste good, but that's all it is. And then I was like, well, that was even a stupid thought. But to want a drink? No. To need a drink? No. But I'm an alcoholic, and I got to remember that. I fear sometimes that this gift has been given to me so easily that I'll take it for granted. You know, I know staying in the fellowship, being with people, telling my stories, I often, you know, go, well, why don't you go to speakers meetings? Why don't you, you know, go to more meetings and tell people your story? And I was thinking, well, my story is pretty boring. You know, I drank, I got drunk, I had a seizure, I got sober, and I'm good. But it's not that simple. And no, I'm not good. I mean, I'm okay for today. But, you know, the big book to me is a book of life. You can put almost any word in there for alcohol, and it'll work. It teaches you how to live, to own up to your mistakes. And that to me is just been such a blessing. The other day, any of you Portuguese, my daughter's a queen of a Portuguese festa, and I was on the phone talking to another lady, and sometimes I can be sort of short, you know, for to the point and short, but I didn't realize it. And anyway, we had a conversation, and I hung up, and I'm good for the evening. It's about 9 o'clock at night, and my daughter comes right up to me, and she goes, Mom, you know, you were just a little abrupt with her. And I'm going, no, I wasn't. She goes, yeah, you were. So I immediately went to the phone and said, my daughter, Stephanie, she goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm calling her. And she's like, why? I said, well, you know, if I've done wrong, I need to make my amends right there. So I called the lady up and, you know, I said, you listen, you know, my daughter said I might have been a little abrupt, you know, and I'm sorry if I was, you know, I don't mean to hurt any, your feelings. And, you know, I talked to her for a little bit. She goes, oh, no, we're okay. We're good. We're good. So I hung up the phone, and I felt that I went to sleep easy that night because I knew my side of the street was clean. Whether I had said something to her that she took offense with, she can go to bed with that if she wants. But I'm good. I did the next indicated step. And that's what this has taught me. That's what AA has taught me. That's what I learned from my, you know, fellow alcoholics from the book. That, you know, when they first said, let go, let God, oh, I was so ready for that. I'm like, yeah. I was at the fair one time, and I've told a few people this before, and my daughter shows heifers. And normally I'm like, oh, they poop, or oh, they need stuff. I'm like, go. And the heifer starts pooping, and I'm like, let it go. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I don't think that's exactly what they mean by let go and let God, because he ain't going to come down here and pick up that crap. I've got to take some kind of an action, which is picking up the crap in this case. So I realize now that, you know, in God, all things are possible, but, you know, there's a little bit of footwork I have to do. I'm also one of those who want, I pray. But, you know, I want those post-it notes. I want God to give me a post-it note saying, Connie, okay, this is your problem, so this is what you need to do. Because I don't want to get it wrong. You know, I'm like going, I ponder on if I have a problem, and I'm like, should I do this? Should I do that? And I'm never 100% sure, but one thing I am sure about is if I do nothing, the problem's still going to be there. So I've got to do something. You know, I stand up here and I feel like I should have some wisdom after 6 years. But the only thing I got is I don't drink. It's the only thing I've done 100%. You know, when I first got sober, you know, I went to the meetings, I got the sponsor, I was a good girl. I called her every day at a certain time. And, oh, if I was late, I almost felt like, oh, God, can I call her now? Because I'm late. She's going to be mad at me. But, you know, I got in that routine. And I followed the routine. I read the book. I did what I was told. I went to meetings. And needlessly to say, once again, I don't go to meetings like I should. I don't call my sponsor like I should. She's looking at me. But I call them when I really need to. I know there's a fellowship. She asked me when I first met her. I first asked someone to sponsor me. The lady, you know, all I heard was the word no. But actually what she said was, I have someone else that, you know, maybe would be better for you. And this is when I met my sponsor. But she wanted to meet me at Denny's. And I'm like going, crap. I got an interview for this? You know, you've got to be kidding. I didn't know this is the way this went. And she asked me, she goes, well, Connie, what do you expect? What do you want from me? And I told her right then, I said, I want a friend. I want someone I can talk to. I live out in the country. I didn't drink out in the public much. I drank at home. I would drink a 1.75 liter, the big liter, of Seagram 7 a day. Don't know how I did it, but that's what I was looking for. I needed a friend. And I got a friend. Not only did I get a friend, I got a whole friggin' fellowship. And how cool is that? Men, women that have, I thought I had absolutely nothing in common with. And a lot of you, I don't have a lot in common with. But I have the biggest thing that's important is we're all alcoholics. We all, you know, have a problem with alcohol, and we needed help. I told myself when I came here, I said I wasn't going to be using the word we because this is, you know, I should keep it in my story. So I needed help. I needed a fellowship and I needed friends. And that's what I've gotten. You know, I spent so much of my daughter's life, we'd be outside playing soccer, and she must have thought I had the smallest bladder in the world. Because I was constantly running inside to go pee, but no, I was just going to take a swig of, from the whiskey bottle. I don't care whether it's soccer, baseball, whatever, I was just, you know, and carrying, I always, even when I went to somewhere, I had a bottle in my purse. Well, I had to go to the bathroom at the restaurant. You know, I had to go to the bathroom, you know, at the park, just so I could get another drink. But, you know, I thought I was doing fine. I was okay. Because I didn't have withdrawals. And you say I was drunk. It's pretty hard to have withdrawals when you're drunk. So when I first came into AA, you know, as I said, I was ready. I didn't want to drink anymore, but people kept telling me, you need a support group, you need some backup, you need a backup plan. And so I went to AA, and, you know, I just found such warmth and compassion and understanding that even if I stand up here and ramble, make no sense, act like a fool, I know none of you are going to leave here just going, what a fruitcake! Well, you might, but that's okay because you probably must have me pegged. I am just very thankful that God has given me this gift, and I don't want to take it for granted. This isn't a throwback gift. This isn't something that someone's given you a t-shirt and you've gotten a stain on it and you throw away. No, this is a gift that, you know, I want to keep. It's the greatest gift I've been given. When I first got sober, I also thought I've got to be really, not self-centered, but that it was all about me, that I was really selfish. You know, all of a sudden here, I've spent my whole life taking care of my daughter, my husband, and in the way my husband was raised, the woman stays home, the woman takes care of everything. She doesn't go out, she doesn't do things on her own. And here all of a sudden I was going out at night to meetings and I thought, how selfish am I? I didn't cook them a hot dinner. I didn't tuck my daughter into bed. You know, but then as time went by the fog started to clear, I realized that coming in these AA meetings was the most selfless thing I've ever done. Because not only have I given myself me back, I've given my daughter a mother who is not only physically there, but mentally there. You know, that can understand and feel. My emotions were so screwed up. I mean, I could watch the news and cry. I could watch a sitcom, I could watch a sitcom and cry and watch the news and laugh. And that was no, you know, I was all backwards. I didn't know what emotion to feel, when to feel it. Alcohol was the only thing I knew. God has given me, as I keep saying, a gift, because I can't express that enough, that I don't want to lose it. And the only way I could think of not losing it is to try to stay in touch. I say some people, you know, I hear, you know, want to go to a meeting, you know, every day, one, a couple times a week, once a week. Honestly, I'll go months. But I always think of it as you learn how to play baseball, you learn the proper swing. You learn how to play golf. You learn all, you're given the instructor, you're given the fundamentals, you learn how to do the swing. Just by the book. But then, as time goes, you find that a little different swing works better for you than with this other person. So there's no perfect or absolute way to run this program. We all have freedom of choice. We all know our needs now. I know that I have people I can talk to. I know where the meetings are at. When I feel I need them, that's where I'm going to be. And as I've always been told, even when I feel I don't need them, that's probably still where I should be. But I'm trying to learn to live life. I'm staying active. I do volunteer work. I help out at my daughter's school. And that's my way, just my personal way of giving back. And it works for me. That's the way I've changed my swing. The big book is there. It's my guide for life. It's taught me, and it continues to teach me. Because once I can't learn anymore, once I think I can't learn anymore, I know I'm heading down the wrong road. You know, I've got to be teachable. I've always heard that. And I consider myself still teachable. I don't always listen, but I am teachable. And I just take one day at a time. I do the best I can. I don't drink. And I try not to take my gift for granted. Nothing changes if nothing changes is true to me. But, you know, it's knowing when to change. What I got going is working. And that's what I want to continue to do. When I'm feeling it's not working well, then I'm going to change my swing a little bit. Maybe it's a couple meetings every night or every week. But I used to always wait when I was, when I got sober, I kept thinking, this is too easy. You know, I'd go to my counselor there at the recovery center saying, you know, something's wrong, this is too easy. And she said, Connie, quit waiting for the other shoe to fall. You'll know when it falls and then take care of it. But don't look a gift horse in the mouth. And that's what I'm trying not to do. And, you know, when I got this call and I was asked to come talk, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to say. And honestly, I'm going to have to buy one of those tapes because I didn't rehearse anything, so I'm just sort of talking whatever comes out of my mouth. And it's just a wonderful feeling. My family's been behind me. My father went to Al-Anon when I first got sober. You know, because being a father, you know, he had a little bit of guilt. He thought he had done something wrong. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways. He went to one Al-Anon. The meeting happened to be, it's not your fault. All right, he took that and ran. You know, okay, I heard what I needed. I'm good. But he has always been supportive for me. Everyone in my family has. And God's timing for me, I'll hit on real quick, was just, it's perfect timing. It's God's timing. And of course it's perfect. Right after I was went into rehab and got sober, my mother became extremely ill. She lost her entire colon, almost died. So I was able to be there. If I would have been drinking, that would have happened to her 6 months prior, it would have given me my excuse to drink, to continue to drink. But I was sober. I was able to go down. I was able to help take care of her. And she made it for another 4 years until she finally passed on. And I was there and present for that. My father a year ago had a heart attack. I was there and present for that. I'm going down after this meeting down to Bakersfield to help my father out because he has a little something going on tomorrow. If I was be drinking, I wouldn't be able to do that. Now, I'm the designated driver. You know, and that's a wonderful feeling. I used to always say, well, I should have gotten pulled over for being drunk. I should have, when I had the episode with the children, the school should have turned me in to child services. But then I thought, well, you know, should isn't the proper word to use. Because if that was God's plan, then yeah, they should have, and I should have, and I should have been in jail. But no, they could have, but that wasn't God's plan.